Through these gates have passed the mortal remains of more than 150,000 souls, all on their final journey to the cold ground of the hillside beyond. There they lie at rest in the 51,800 graves which generations of sextons have dug for them. These are the Sexton's Tales. Since it first opened in 1836, Highgate Cemetery has been celebrated as one of the most magical places in London. William Justine's Guide to Highgate Cemetery, published in 1865, extols its charms. In the genial summertime, when the birds are singing blithely in their leafy recesses and the well-cared-for graves are dazzling with the varied hues of beautiful flowers, there is a holy loveliness upon this place of death, as if the kind angels hovered about it and quickened fair nature with their presence in love for the good souls whose tenantless bodies repose there. It is almost hard to believe that the cemetery was also the scene of a dreadful exhumation, a story that both touches the heart and disturbs the soul. In 1849, Elizabeth Eleanor Siddle, the daughter of a cutler originally from Sheffield, was working as a milliner's assistant at Mrs. Tozier's hat shop in Cranbourne Alley, a picturesque passage just off London's Piccadilly. Lizzie's elegant beauty and waist-length copper-gold hair attracted more than just passing admiration. The young, up-and-coming artist Walter Deverell, shopping in the West End with his mother, was instantly smitten on first sight. He'd recently started work on a scene from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, and Lizzie's luminous beauty was to Deverell the manifest to a perfect Viola. Too shy to ask her himself, he asked his mother to intercede.
Yes, indeed, it is a very fine chapeau, but it is not to purchase a hat that I came into your establishment today. You see, my son, Walter Deverell, is an artist, and a very fine young artist, even if I do say so myself. That's him there with his nose to the window. Walter, do take your nose from the glass.
You see, Walter thinks you are the perfect model for one of his new paintings, and has asked me to ask you if you would consider sitting for him, my dear.
Elizabeth's weekly wage of 9 shillings was an important source of income to her family. Her father's business in the London borough of Southwark provided poor takings, barely enough to feed the family of 10, and the thought of being paid a shilling an hour, the going rate for models at the time, was an attractive proposition. Elizabeth accepted the assignment, though not without a passing worry. It was well known that to save money, artists stored their model sketches for future use, and better women than she had found their reputation in tatters when, months after a respectable sitting, their faces suddenly appeared on top of a foreign naked body in a scene of mythological lust. ¶¶ Walter Devereux couldn't contain the secret of his new discovery, and the very evening after Elizabeth's first sitting, he excitedly sought out his friends Gabriel Dante Rossetti, William Holman Hunt, and John Everett Millais, three young artists who had recently founded the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood.
You fellows can't tell what a stupendously beautiful creature I found. By Jove, she's like a queen. Magnificently tall, with a lovely figure, a stately neck, and a face of the most delicate and finished modelling. The flow of surface from her temples over the cheeks is exactly like the carving of a Phidian goddess. And her hair is like a dazzling copper, shimmering with lustre as she waves it down. Oh, Gabrielle, you'll swoon.
Walter was right. As soon as they saw Elizabeth, they were smitten by her beauty and all begged her to model for them too. To Holman Hunt, she became a red-haired Celt in his Christian sheltering from the persecution of the Druids. To Millais, tragic Ophelia. Her clothes spread wide and mermaid-like in a bath he'd set up in his studio, a pose which nearly killed Lizzie when the oil lamps heating the bath water from below went out and she caught pneumonia. But to Rossetti, she was more than merely just another pretty model. He had fallen deeply in love with Lizzie at first sight. When first I saw her, I felt my destiny defined. She is to me as beautiful as the reflection of a golden mountain in a crystal lake. His affections were returned, and within a few months they had become inseparable. Gabrielle moved into a set of three ramshackled rooms in Chatham Place, near the River Thames by Blackfriars Bridge, and set up his studio. From that day forth, Lizzie modelled for no one else. Cocooned from family and friends in their own intimate haven, Gabrielle began to teach Lizzie to paint and write poetry, and she, a willing pupil, flowered under his tutelage. That they adored each other, there is no doubt. Gabrielle sketched Lizzie incessantly, and the numerous pencil drawings of her are full of warmth and affection. But their relationship remained intangible, their love expressed not with a physical, but rather an idealistic, remote passion. On June 20th, 1853, Gabrielle accepted an invitation from the painter and poet William Bell Scott and travelled to his home in Newcastle. In the quiet of the studio, Lizzie started her first work in oils, a self-portrait, but she quickly discovered that Chatham Place was far from an ideal habitation for someone of a weak disposition. The Fleet Ditch, one of London's principal sewers, emptied its germ-ridden filth into the Thames at Blackfriars, just across the river from the studio. A sickly, sweet miasma hung over the entire area, a nauseating mist that filled the nostrils and clung to the throat. When Gabrielle returned from Newcastle, he found Lizzie sick and in pain. A doctor was hastily summoned, one of the many she was to see in the coming years, but the diagnosis to her ailment proved elusive. She became listless, lost her appetite, vomiting everything she tried to eat, and spent weeks in bed. Her illness had a profound effect on their relationship. Gabrielle was a healthy young man of 24 with an inherited Latin libido, and Lizzie, though willing to risk her reputation, balked at the shame of an unwanted pregnancy. As Lizzie's health slowly improved, the possibility of any marriage seemed to recede. Cholera was now raging in the neighbourhood, and the gutters ran with chloride of lime. A close friend suggested that Lizzie should move to a new sanatorium, which had recently opened at No. 1 Harley Street. The Institute for the Care of Sick Gentlewomen was run by the formidable Miss Nightingale, recently returned from the Crimea. Instead, Lizzie gathered together a few scant belongings and, using the sum generated from the sale of her first watercolour, travelled to the resort of Hastings. It was the first time in her life that she had ever seen the sea. The ocean enchanted Lizzie, and her visits to Hastings set a pattern which, for the next 10 years, governed her on-off engagement with Gabrielle. Her ill health forced him away, and his absence fueled her sickness. A doctor prescribed laudanum, a tincture of opium and alcohol frequently taken to calm the stomach, and during those troubled years, she became hopelessly addicted. In the spring of 1860, after receiving note that Lizzie was seriously ill in Hastings, Gabriel rushed to her bedside. He found her so weak that she could scarcely raise her head from the pillow. Begging her forgiveness, he asked for her hand in marriage. In a letter to his mother dated Friday the 13th of April, Gabriel wrote, "Like all the important things I ever meant to do, to fulfil duty or secure happiness, this one has been deferred almost beyond possibility. I have hardly deserved that Lizzie should still consent to it. But she has done so, and I trust I may still have time to prove my thankfulness to her." And so, on the 23rd of May 1866, at St. Clement's Church in Hastings, they were betrothed. It was almost a decade since first they had met. Lizzie was 30 and Gabrielle 32. The wedding was a quiet affair with no friends or family present, and the register was signed by strangers. Straight away, the couple left for a combined honeymoon and recuperation in Paris. Within a year of their return to London, they were installed in Spring Cottage, Hampstead, close to Keats House. Lizzie's health continued to improve, and she discovered to their joy that she was pregnant. Gabrielle was working hard, and their future together seemed blessed, but the joy and happiness was not to last. In mid-April, the child stopped moving in the womb, and on the 2nd of May, their baby daughter was stillborn. "Life and night are falling from me. Death and day are opening on me. Hollowed hearts are ever near me. Soulless eyes have ceased to cheer me. Lord, may I come. My outward life feels sad and still, like lilies in a frozen rill. I'm gazing upward to the sun, Lord. Lord, remembering my lost one. Oh, Lord. Remember me." They never got over the loss. Gabrielle had to travel to Yorkshire to paint a lucrative portrait and, left alone, Lizzie withdrew into her own grief. Friends who called found her rocking an empty cradle, hushing the ghost of her dead child. Her health began to deteriorate once again, and Lizzie found a numb solace with the laudanum bottle. On his return to London, Gabriel resolved to lift Lizzie's depression and arrange for them to dine with friends at the Hotel Sablonnière, a glamorous restaurant in Leicester Square. Lizzie, who had taken a large dose of laudanum, was in unnaturally high spirits, but by the end of the meal had become so drowsy that Gabrielle took her home and put her to bed. He then left with the friends and returned a few hours later. Arriving home at 11:30, Gabrielle took off his boots before mounting the stairs to the bedroom. He couldn't have known that Lizzie was already dead to the world. She lay in bed, an empty laudanum bottle to her side and a note pinned to her nightdress. What that note read, we'll never know. Gabrielle burnt it in the fireplace before calling a doctor, the same doctor who'd attended her confinement. Together, they tried to revive her, but with no success. Elizabeth died in the early hours of Tuesday, February the 11th, 1862. She had taken a massive overdose. Thank you.
Gabrielle was beside himself with grief, convinced she was not dead at all, but merely lay in a laudanum-induced coma. For the next week, he kept her body in an open coffin.
Lizzie, come back. Come back to me.
On the day of the funeral, as a final parting gesture, Gabrielle took the grey calf-covered notebook in which she'd kept all the poems he'd ever written for his beloved Lizzie and tucked it amongst the curls of her hair. She took those words of love to her grave. After the burial, Gabrielle destroyed all that reminded him of Elizabeth, burning letters and poems as if to purge himself of her memory. Seven years after Lizzie's death, in 1869, Gabrielle had moved to a gloomy mansion in Cheyne Walk, Chelsea, and was on the verge of bankruptcy. In dire need of income, he sold his last few remaining pictures, then suddenly his mind lit on the unpublished poems lying with his long-dead wife. I have left instructions with my agent, Charles Howell, that the grave should be open to retrieve my works, though I am unable to face the grisly task myself and have left London for the country until the deed is done. While walking today, the 5th of October, a chaffinch suddenly flew down and settled on my hand, and I knew straight away that this visitor was Lizzie's spirit, the soul of her taken shape. On my return to the house, I was informed that the great bell at the door, which needed a strong pull to ring, had been rung, and by nobody, as if warning me of peril to come.
For leave to exhume the body of the late wife of Mr. D. G. Rossetti, interred in the grave in the Highgate Cemetery, for the purpose of obtaining a book placed in the coffin, by virtue of the power vested in me by the 25th section of the Acts 20 and 21, signed Henry Austin Bruce, Her Majesty's Secretary for the Home Office.
On the 5th of October 1869, as the bell of St. Michael's Church at the top of Highgate Hill struck midnight, the legal hour for disinterment, a small party of men assembled at the Rossetti family grave. Amongst them a blacksmith ready with his tools to open the lead-lined casket and a doctor engaged to disinfect the manuscript lest any contagion be transmitted from the dead to the living. The lifting gear had already been assembled and a small bonfire blazed by the graveside to protect against infection. The heavy casket, identified by its brass nameplate, was hauled to the surface and lowered gently beside the open grave before the blacksmith, chisel in hand, set to work. As the lid was levered back and the casket opened, the assembled men as one gasped and stood back with shock and disbelief. Lizzie's body was perfectly preserved. She looked as if she'd merely slept the 7 years since her burial, so perfect were her features, preserved by opium as if in formaldehyde. The only thing which had changed was her hair. Waist length in life, it had continued to grow after death, and in the flickering light from the fire, seemed to fill the coffin with a golden haze. The grey calf-covered notebook of poems was disentangled from her curls and the coffin hastily resealed and reburied. Those present sworn to secrecy. Of course, the story leaked out, and when the newspapers got hold of it, Gabrielle was forced to defend his actions. The truth is, no one so much as herself would have approved of my doing this. Art was the only thing for which she felt seriously. Had it been possible to her, I should have found the book on my pillow the night she was buried. The transcriptions were published a year later and made a handsome profit, but even though his bank balance benefited, Gabriel's health suffered dreadfully. He took to drowning his sorrows with quantities of chloral, a hypnotic sedative, washing it down with glasses of whiskey, and had the first of a series of strokes. By the time of his death, on the 9th of April 1882, Easter Sunday, he was half blind and barely capable of tottering a few steps. Who shall say what is said in me, with all that I might have been dead in me? He left instructions that on no account was he to be buried with his wife, and his funeral at Birchington in Kent was kept quiet to delay the onslaught of creditors. So there we have it. The tale of poor Lizzie Siddle and tragic Gabriel Dante Rossetti. A story of love and overwhelming sadness, and one of the only two exhumations which ever took place at Highgate Cemetery. The other? That's a story for another day. There is, however, a sting in the end of this sorrowful tale. A year to the day after Lizzie's exhumation, Charles Augustus Howell, Gabrielle's agent, the man who organised the retrieval of the poems, was found dead in the gutter with his throat cut and a 10-shilling piece clenched between his teeth. I'm Emlyn Harris. You've been listening to A Sexton's Tale. The Sexton's Tales were written, narrated and produced by Emlyn Harris. The original soundtrack was composed and orchestrated by the author.